From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, the Golden Globe nominations are out, but what are we really to make of them? Then the curators of an exhibit about the year 1919 make 100 years seem not so far away.
Rather than kind of hammering away on the 1919-2019 parallels, what we hoped is that people moving through would make those connections themselves.
And an opera about struggling artists is revived in the middle of a gentrification hotspot. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. But we're about to hear from John. He's covered the movie industry for more than two decades as a print reporter, and so we figured he's the best person to explain the significance, or lack thereof, of the Golden Globe Awards. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association today announced the nominees for its annual awards, which take place in early January. But rather than detail the usual inexplicable nominee choices and snubs, we thought we'd talk about the relationship between movie fans, the Globes, and the entertainment industry. First, John tells us who makes up the association.
What's important to me about the Golden Globes and about some other kind of minor film awards is that this is not a representative body. There are about 90 journalists, and if you go on the website for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, you can no longer even find their names or where they work. It's a very small group of people, and they have undue influence because the movie studios have figured out that if they woo the voters for the Golden Globes and their filmmakers win awards at the Golden Globes, it kind of creates some sort of momentum for the Academy Awards, but none of it is very legitimate. And the HFPA has cleaned itself up. It's not as scandal-ridden as it has been in years past, but this isn't an elite group of film writers or film critics that are making these selections. And if you look closely at the selections, not just this year, but in past years, the fact that they aren't really that serious as kind of film lovers starts to reveal itself pretty quickly.
How so?
Well, let's talk about a couple of past nominations. 2013, there were three nominations for a movie I bet you've never heard of, Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. That was a Golden Globe whopper. And if you go back 9 years to 2010, there was a movie with Johnny Depp called The Tourist that was largely derided that ended up getting multiple nominations at the Golden Globes. And I think if you look closely at some of the selections this year, it's clear it's driven by the red carpet. Like, who do they want to have on the red carpet? You look in the TV category, there are multiple nominations for The Morning Show, a Apple series that didn't get great reviews, because Jennifer Aniston is coming, Reese Witherspoon is coming as nominees. And then you look at Ava DuVernay's When They See Us, one of the most critically acclaimed TV series of the past year, didn't get any nominations.
So it's important for the NBC show to, you know, have that star clout. So there's eyeballs. So people watch.
I think that's part of the bias historically for the Golden Globes, that you can say, if they're judging between good filmmaker and A-list name, they generally are going to vote for the A-list name. And they also have some historical biases, you know, that are shared by the Academy. In the 77-year history of the Globes, only five women have ever been nominated for Best Director. And this year, there are lots of really good female filmmakers that were up. Greta Gerwig for Little Women, Olivia Wilde for Booksmart, Alma Harrell for Honey Boy, Marielle Heller for Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Not one of them got nominated. So the Golden Globes has a pretty poor history when it comes to nominating women.
The Golden Globes has made some effort to try to rehabilitate this reputation. What has it done?
It's made sure that people who are members actually have legitimate credits as journalists. There have been some reports of, I guess you could call it, bribery or expensive gifts in the past. I think they've tried to eliminate all of that. So again, they have cleaned up their act. But there's only so much legitimacy you can bring to yourself when you're only 90 journalists writing for publications that, if we had the names, I guarantee you, you've probably never heard of them.
And yet the industry, I guess, mostly plays along, and an actor or director or studio can use success at the Globes as part of their campaign going into Oscar season.
100%. And I think that is one of the most interesting parts of the story. Everybody in Hollywood knows in their soul that the Golden Globes are really not totally legitimate. And yet, the studios and independent companies and marketing departments embrace them because they recognize there's a game to be played. And the game is, we are going to court the Golden Globe voters. We're going to have screenings and Q&As for them. And if we get a nomination, our actor or our filmmaker is going to be on their award show, and people are going to start talking about the film, and one thing begets the other. But they do know that really it's not totally legit, but it serves their purposes. Academy Award campaigning is a multi-million dollar business. There are people who work as campaign consultants who get hundreds of thousands of dollars for getting nominations or Oscar wins. There is a huge business behind all of this. And in some ways, it might drive ticket sales or people to stream movies. So it's driven by finance. It's driven by trying to get eyeballs on the movies. But it's all kind of a hustle.
So, John, I've never covered the entertainment industry that closely. So, like a lot of people in the public, I really always just saw the Golden Globe Awards as the first among that more high-profile award shows to spotlight the top films of the year going into Oscar seasons. Am I off on that?
Well, you're not technically off. I mean, because the Hollywood Foreign Press Association nominates in two different categories for most of the major film awards, they cast a wider net. So just mathematically, they're bound to include a lot of movies that end up getting nominated. I wouldn't say they're that much of a bellwether, but because they're embracing so many movies, they have a mathematical chance of getting most of those things right.
John Horn out in New York. John, thanks for joining us to talk about the Golden Globes. We'll see you when you get back.
Thanks for sitting in.
And before airtime, we reached out to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to request a list of voting members and the news outlets they represent. They declined our request. Coming up on The Frame, I'll look back at a turbulent year. Not 2019, but 1919. If you've ever been to the Huntington in San Marino, not far from our studios in Pasadena, you know it's easy to spend an entire day just strolling through the neatly manicured botanical gardens. But next time you're there, don't skip the library and the art museum. In celebration of the Huntington's founding 100 years ago by Henry and Arabella Huntington, the exhibition 1919 paints a picture of that first tumultuous year. The exhibit is comprised entirely of items from the Huntington's collection that were either acquired, published, or displayed in 1919. From Benjamin Franklin's handwritten autobiography to suffragist pamphlets celebrating the passage of the 19th Amendment. John Horn recently paid a visit to talk with James Glisson and Jennifer Watts, co-curators of 1919. They explained what Henry Huntington was focused on collecting 100 years ago.
By the time 1919 rolls around, Huntington had purchased on the order of 120,000 items. So it's a huge collection. It was on the East Coast still. And he's still aggressively buying. So he puts in bids at something like 50 auctions that year. He, the week before the trust document is actually signed, one of his favorite dealers brings $121,000 worth of Shakespearean works to the house here in San Marino. So he is still all in, and actually it just ramps it up in the 20s. So he's still buying the great works of British and American history and literature, really focused on the great men of history.
So he is also trying to do something in San Marino and California that I think is important in terms of what we're seeing now. And that is to establish this area as a rival to the East Coast and maybe Europe. And does that start to affect the kinds of things he's buying?
Well, he's very much focused on early American history and literature and early British history and literature. So he's working really hard to collect all the first editions of Shakespeare. He's actually competing with the British Library. And he's also competing with some of the major East Coast institutions. But he's got the leg up because he's buying entire libraries at a time. So all the early papers of Virginia, you know, come here and whatnot. But it's really not until a few years later that he really starts thinking about California as an emphasis for collecting, and Californiana, as we call it. And his librarians really start going in whole hog on that. I mean, Huntington is creating history as he's settling here by bringing this institution here, but also by just the very fact that he's brought the streetcar system. He's real estate is his main occupation, and he's laying out suburbs. So he's sort of, history's in the making with Huntington here.
Like anybody who is collecting art at the time, Henry Huntington has a European white male focus. And that is reflected in a lot of what you see in the art gallery walls. When you're thinking about how you can represent a broader spectrum of the country at that time, at 1919, are there things in the collection that can illustrate beyond what Huntington himself might have been drawn to? Because his collection, his focus was pretty narrow, as were a lot of people at that time.
So keep in mind that while this exhibition is about the year 1919, it includes items brought to the Huntington all the way up to 2019. So some moments in the show where we tell other stories are the U.S. Marshal's papers, for instance, that are right here. They're the kind of parole records, so to speak, for German citizens who were required to report to the Marshal's office once a week and kind of check in. Other German citizens were jailed under pretty flimsy charges. We have an amazing book by Delilah Beasley. It's the history of African Americans in California, published in 1919. We have Wobbly, Industrial Workers of the World literature. We also have a lot of material, believe it or not, about the German Revolution. So one thing, it was a discovery of Jenny's, in fact. The Huntington has an extraordinary collection of German posters from roughly 1917 to about 1920, 1921. We've got 10,000 of them. We've got four on the wall. And one of them reads, warning, I'm translating, stopping is prohibited. Rioters will be shot. This is an image from the German Revolution of January 1919, which was a short-lived communist revolution. And I think that's definitely a story along with the Wobbly material and along with this U.S. Marshals material that one might not expect to encounter at the Huntington.
So much of what you're talking about suggests what's going to happen in the years and decades to follow. The registration of German Americans suggests the internment that's going to happen during World War II. There are artifacts about the Wobblies and about the fight to unionize and the penalties that some union organizers faced, which was death and lynching. And then there are things like the German Revolution. When you start thinking about what this snapshot of 1919 represents, how much of the future history of the country and the world do you think is really told if you start looking closely at what we're seeing here?
An extraordinary amount. So really, it's the mishandling or the stumbles at the Versailles Peace Conference that set the stage for the Second World War. It's the social chaos in Germany in 1919 and the near breakdown of civil order right as the Weimar Constitution's being written. That sets the stage for the rise of the Nazis in the 1930s. Isolationism and American foreign policy for the 20s and 30s becomes set at this moment. But it's not, as I like to try to say, it's not all bad. So women get the right to vote. Huntington's streetcar system is kind of at its apogee in 1919. And that's the sort of backbone around which the metropolis of LA would continue to grow for another 40 or 50 years before they ripped it up and put in the freeway. And what we hoped in setting up the exhibition is that people moving through would make those connections themselves rather than kind of hammering away on the 1919, 2019 parallels. Let people make those connections themselves. And certainly you did it. So
I want to look at some maps. So can we go walk at some maps? There are some amazing maps around us right now. Mm-hmm. What is this epic map that goes almost across the entire gallery? What is this?
So this is an epic map. This is a 39-foot-long linen map, rolled linen map, which is completely unrolled. It's the first time we've ever unrolled it, which is depicting and delineating the Pasadena Short Line red car system from Old Town Pasadena all the way to the outskirts of downtown Los Angeles, drawn over decades. The short line opened in 1902 and was going for many, many decades. So everything that's shown on this map reveals not only the route of the Pacific Electric red car, but all the contiguous real estate holdings, the titles to land, the deeds, the changes in place names, the additions of towns, but it really shows the extent to which transportation and real estate are intertwined in the city of Los Angeles. Really, Huntington put in his transportation network to get people to his real estate holdings. It was a loss leader for him. And so he was really trying to move people out to the hinterlands where he had built these suburbs. And remember, these suburbs also had racially restrictive covenants on them, as did many of these neighborhoods that the streetcar's going through. So it's just an amazing time to really reflect on the demographics and the topography of the city and how it got to be the way it is.
How does sound and music play into this show? I saw that you put together a Spotify playlist. What elements of music are represented either visually, or do you want people to walk around the gallery listening to their Spotify playlist about the Huntington show?
Well, right here on the wall, we have some sheet music covers, and I think just reading the titles give you a sense. So there's Salvation Lassie of Mine. She's in an army uniform, and you can see in the distance a bunch of soldiers heading into what looks like a canteen. There's another called I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, and it's this woman looking in the distance surrounded by a whole bunch of bubbles. Let the Rest of the World Go By, My Baby's Arms.
I call my sweetheart.
You'd Be Surprised by Irving Berlin. And then my favorite, How You Gonna Keep Them Down on the Farm After They've Seen Paris.
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town?
And what all of these started to say to us is that this was a really a moment of nostalgia. So for all of the world-changing events, for the horrors of the war, for the tragedies of the Red Summer and the violence against African Americans that year, you know, popular culture, pop culture, that's what this is, isn't reflecting that. Instead, it's giving us a nostalgic light view. And we felt like this the room we're standing in is called Return, and the Return section is not just about soldiers coming home, but about this desire to kind of turn the clock back, which we all know isn't possible.
James and Jenny, thanks so much for having us in.
Yes, thanks a lot, John.
Thanks.
That was John Horn with Jennifer Watts and James Glisson, co-curators of 1919 at the Huntington Museum. The exhibit is open through January 20th. Coming up on The Frame, an L.A. opera company takes on the issue of gentrification with a reimagining of one of the greatest Italian operas of the 19th century. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. In neighborhoods across L.A., battle lines have been drawn over gentrification. Artists and other creative types seek less expensive neighborhoods. Landlords and developers want more commerce. Longtime residents and community activists argue for affordable housing and preserving tradition. They are fights that define the oldest of cities, which brings us to Giacomo Puccini. One of the Italian composer's greatest operas, La Bohème, famously revolves around a group of Parisian artists and writers struggling to create and to pay the rent. It was first performed in Los Angeles more than 120 years ago. Now, the Pacific Opera Project is staging the opera in an L.A. neighborhood at the center of a gentrification battle. Marcos Najera has our story.
These days, the sound of sopranos fills Highland Park's Ebel Club on Avenue 57. But once upon a time, this was an elite club for women to study. It was even a safe house for the suffragettes, according to some news accounts. More recently, the Pacific Opera Project, or POP for short, has called this place home.
The furthest seat from the stage is not even 50 feet. We get 42 tables in somehow.
That is Pop's artistic director, Josh Shaw. He's talking about how he and his opera company have turned this unexpected space into a rough but totally delightful concert hall.
There's nowhere else in the world, sometimes I think, where you can be hearing people this talented, this excited about singing, that close.
This month, the Pacific Opera Project is reviving one of its holiday classics, of sorts. It's called La Bohème, a.k.a. The Hipsters. Shaw admits that this staging of Puccini's classic tale, pitting artists against the elites, carries some irony with it. After all, Highland Park is quickly becoming more hipster than Hispanic, much to the chagrin of neighborhood activist groups who don't welcome those too-cool-for-school bars or the new restaurants fit for foodies. And just a few blocks away, residents of an apartment building have been conducting a months-long rent strike against their landlord to protest a rent hike for a building they say badly needs repairs. On the flip side, Shaw says the whole point of staging his company's productions here is not to be exclusive, not to be expensive or snobby. Quite the opposite, in fact.
Accessible, affordable, and most of all, entertaining. That's the three key words at Pop. And, you know, there's no reason that opera shouldn't be. It's entertainment. It's art, but it's also entertainment.
Puccini's Bohème takes place on the streets of 1830s Paris. It's Christmas Eve, and the poet Rodolfo and his friends try to stay warm while scrounging up rent money. It's not long before he falls in love with the pretty girl next door, Mimi. In Pop's production, it's 2019. We're in Highland Park, and the Bohemians have been replaced by hipsters. Real-life couple Dane Suarez and Carrie-Anne Otaño play Rodolfo and Mimi.
These characters are just sort of effortlessly real. It's like this community of singers and artists and creative people. So it's a thing that I think people still relate to, which is really dope.
And I can't lie. I mean, you know, like, I think probably my way into La Bohème was definitely Rent.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, if you're like me, you owe lots of thanks for any knowledge of this classic opera to the hit Broadway show, Rent.
Same. I mean, I
go. No, you don't have to make me feel better.
I never would. When Dane and I drove across country to move to California, we shredded our voices belting all of Rent. Like, we played it while we were...
We still know all the words.
We still know all the words.
Here's Dane Suarez.
We are Mimi and Roger, obviously. And so it's this telling of the story. I mean, there's so many like lines in that Jonathan Larson took literally directly translated from the libretto of La Bohème, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like the, would you light my candle? They're meeting in the apartment.
Gotta light.
I know you.
But also the Musetta's waltz, which is such a huge part of Rent, when Musetta comes in, she sings "Quandom and Vote." That means when I walk down the street, everybody, men and women, look at me.
You sing the Rent part and then sing the Italian song.
Every single day.
So she sings "Quandom and Vote, Quandom and Vote, soletta per la via, la gente sosta mira," which means every single day
I walk down the street.
I hear people say, baby, so sweet. Ever since puberty, everybody says at me, boys, girls, I can't help it, baby.
So be kind and don't lose.
Isn't
that crazy?
Well, that's kind of cool because then people like me who love are rent heads too. That's a door in, right?
It totally is. And it makes you feel, because I think that's the thing that's so important about accessibility with opera, is opera was written for us. It was written for people like us, for regular people, especially the stories that Puccini wrote, because he didn't write about, you know, kings and queens and gods and goddesses. He wrote about real people with real problems. He wrote about artists. He wrote about, for all of his works.
It's called Verismo, which in Italian just means true.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Nájera.
La Boheme, a.k.a. The Hipsters, will be performed December 11th, 13th, and 14th at the Highland Park Ebel Club. That story originally aired when the show premiered last winter, so the casting may have changed. And that's all for today. Remember to keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook. We are at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.